You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, January 28th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, we're heading into the weeds, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to put this to rest for once and for all. Professor Alan Manning from the London School of Economics will be with us to tell us why raising the minimum wage does not necessarily, and in fact does not often, cause any job loss. In fact, it can do the opposite. The concept is monopsony.
Did this guy ever run things?
I don't know if people understand that. We'll get to that in a second. Also, on the program, on the the day of the State of the Union address, President Obama, it's being reported he will be pursuing more executive action in 2014. The whys and whats we will discuss later in the program. However, it has been announced that by executive action, he will raise the minimum wage for workers of federally contracted contractors, dealing with about 560,000 people, not existing contractors, but in any future contract. So the janitors who work at the Smithsonian, for instance, or there's a whole bevy of people, 560,000 of them. We will talk about that as well. Meanwhile, in Texas, that woman who was being kept alive, brain dead, kept alive to incubate a fetus, has been allowed to die, ladies and gentlemen, according to the will of her family. Also on the program today, a lot of talk about this Tom Perkins guy, the VC who compared the demonization of the 1% in this country to Kristallnacht. Well, he's come out and he's explained his comments, and if he was in deep water before, now he's in super deep water. Thank God he's got such an expensive boat. We will talk about that. Story from last week. Don't know if you heard it. Government panel, another one, has come out and said that the NSA should stop their mass surveillance. We will dig into that. And unreliable source, Howie Kurtz. Apparently, last year when he was claiming that he was not paid for his completely invisible web program, apparently he was, with foundation money. Ugh, disgusting. And we'll play that clip of when Andrea Mitchell had to cut from a conversation about the NSA to a breaking story about Jason Bieber.
Justin Bieber.
Yeah, if it was Jason Bieber, it would be even worse, because who cares what Justin's cousin's doing? We'll get to that. The sound is sort of funny, so we'll get to that. And more prep as of tonight, but we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Professor Alan Manning of the London School of Economics.
Do you want to set up the song?
Oh, and I should also say, sadly, that Pete Seeger has passed away at age of 94. I would imagine that you don't need to hear his obituary from me, but this guy, unbelievably storied life, an amazing activist, and used music to promote that activism in a way that I don't know that we've seen in this country, certainly not over the course of near 75 years. Was active really up until his last days, specifically up in the Hudson Valley area, where he was fighting for to maintain the health of the Hudson River.
In October of 2011, he must have been in his 90s by then for sure, he led an Occupy march around the city.
Yeah. We're going to play... There's obviously hundreds of selections of Pete Seeger's that we could play, but this one Myla really enjoyed quite a bit, actually, for a long time after the inauguration. He and Bruce Springsteen sang This Land Is Our Land, and it's a fairly... I don't know. Was this a socialist song?
I would say it's the socialist national anthem of America.
Indeed. So we will play this song, Pete Seeger, Dead at the Age of 94. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back.
When I was walking that ribbon of highway, as I went walking that ribbon of highway,
that side was made for you and me. This land is your land.
nobody living, ever stop me. I go walking.
Yes, I go walking.
Freedom highway.
Freedom highway.
Nobody living.
Nobody living.
Make me turn back.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Professor Alan Manning of the London School of Economics. Professor, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure.
So, Professor, now we've had some conversations around this concept of monopsony on this program, and I've endeavored to figure out how to pronounce it properly. But let's before we get into the specifics of that, let's just talk generally about the minimum wage. The president tonight in the State of the Union address is going to announce that by executive order he's going to call for a minimum wage of $10.10 for all workers who are working on a federal contract. Tell us about where the minimum wage stands today relative to where it's been historically.
Well, in the United States, it's really quite a lot lower than it was, say, back in the late 1970s. So even the rises that are being talked about to $9 or $10 would simply, you know, go back to what it was in those days.
And by we measure that relative to inflation, but what other mechanisms, what is the, tell us what the difference between measuring it relative to how it's keeping up with inflation versus, say, productivity?
Well, that, when I was talking then, I was talking about it really relative to how much people earn on average, which I think is the right measure because, you know, the economy tends to become more productive over time, and as a result of that, it can support a higher minimum wage. So, you know, this is a proportion of what the average person makes.
Okay. And what is, I mean, it may seem somewhat self-evident, but just lay out some of the relevance and the advantages to both an economy and obviously the people receiving that minimum wage that a minimum wage having a minimum wage provides.
Well, I think the main benefit it offers is that there are quite a lot of workers in the economy who really are vulnerable to being exploited by their employers, and it sort of removes the worst excesses of that. So it's obviously a big benefit to those workers, you know, doing minimum wage jobs. Now, from the employer side, they tend not to like it so much, but actually, when the minimum wage does go up, they grumble about it, but actually the effects of it aren't quite as bad as they make them out. And, you know, that's because when you pay workers a higher wage, they want the job more, so you have less problem with absenteeism, you have less problems with labour turnover, and so those things are costly for employers. So actually, your total costs don't actually go up as much as they might seem at first sight.
And Professor, I mean, could you just back off your phone piece just a little bit, because we're getting just a little bit of reverb. So give us a sense. I mean, obviously, employers are not necessarily in favor of this increased minimum wage. But why don't they have an awareness of what of the savings they get in terms of turnover and in terms of retraining?
I think their problem is that they inevitably see things from their individual perspective. So that if they just unilaterally raise the wage themselves, they would probably be putting themselves at a competitive disadvantage relative to other employers in their sector. But if all employers are forced to do this, then, you know, that goes away. So this is why we can't really rely on individual employers to voluntarily do this, why we need sort of collective action.
And that's interesting because I believe tonight the president, because there is no there has not been any congressional action on this, one of the things he's going to announce tonight is that he's actually met with some major employers around the country and encouraged them to raise their minimum wage. But this is going to be that much less effective. And in some ways, it's going to put those companies at a disadvantage because it's not nationwide.
Yes, but I think, you know, the fact that he's trying to do that, he's you know, trying to get together a group of employers, and he's hoping that that group can be large enough for them to sort of agree, look, if we all do this, we're not going to lose out relative to each other. But obviously he's not including all employers in this, and, you know, that may be the stumbling block that, you know, this group of employers he is talking to think, actually, you know, we're the good guys here, and why are we going to put ourselves at a disadvantage relative to those other employers out there who perhaps don't really care so much about this?
And what of the notion that you know, what does the data say? We've had the opportunity, obviously, with the minimum wage for decades. We've had the opportunity, and also the ability of certain of specific states to raise their minimum wage above the federal standards. I mean, what do we know in terms of what actually happens when the minimum wage is raised in, say, one state versus another state, in terms of job losses? Who suffers those job losses? What is the net? What is the net result of the minimum wage being raised?
Well, I think that the best studies that we have, and there are a lot of studies out there, some of which come to different conclusions, but I think the best studies we have, that the sort of levels of minimum wages that we see in the U.S., it really has no detectable effect on employment at all. That, you know, it manages to raise the wages of the lowest paid workers in the economy without actually harming their chances of getting a job.
And what are the economy wide benefits? I mean, obviously it's helpful if you are a recipient of a raise that can be up towards, I guess, to $3 almost. We were talking about if it is raised up to over $10. But what are the broader benefits to society?
Well, I mean, I think that depends on whether you think inequality in general is a problem in our society. Obviously, countries like the US, the UK as well, have had big rises in inequality over the last sort of 30 years or so. And, you know, I think a lot of people feel that this has sort of got a bit out of hand, really, that, you know, that this actually begins to sort of jeopardize the foundations on which our society is built. Because if you can't really, even if you work hard and you still can't make enough to earn a decent standard of living for you and your family, there's actually something a bit wrong with that. And I think a lot of people agree with that. I think that's why often the minimum wage is really quite a popular policy, even amongst people who otherwise are quite conservative and, you know, disinclined to trust the government to do anything very much.
Well, I mean, aside from the moral arguments, I mean, what's problematic with the levels of inequality that we're seeing just in general?
Well, I think that, I mean, I think the president actually produced, or his Council of Economic Advisers produced a very interesting picture, which it showed that although, for example, the United States thinks of itself as a sort of a land of opportunity in which everyone has a chance to do well for themselves and so on, that actually this is no longer the case, that actually it's a country in which it makes a huge difference whether you're born into a poor family or whether you're born into a rich family, and that if we look at countries across the world, countries with high levels of inequality tend to have very low levels of social mobility. That is, you know, who your parents are matter an awful lot to how well you will do in life. And that's just not really the way that the US, you know, sort of sees itself. So I think actually this sort of goes, you know, quite to the heart of the way in which the United States has historically seen itself as a country.
And to what extent is this type of inequality also just a drag on the broader economy?
Well, I think it can be a drag because also it tends to perhaps, reduce the overall level of spending a little bit. I mean, those people who are poorer tend to spend a higher fraction of their income than those who are wealthy. And particularly in the sort of economic situation we've had in the last few years, there has been a problem with just the general level of spending and confidence in the economy. So it would probably help a little bit there, but I don't think that that's the main argument, the minimum wage, that you're going to boost the level of demand in the economy. I think it's the other arguments are actually a bit more important.
All right, so tell us about this concept of monopsony and I mean, because the, you know, the I guess I've had many who have called this program to argue that it's economics 101, that if you raise the minimum in which employers can hire employees, then they will necessarily employ less people. Please explain to us why that is wrong.
Yes, well, I'll try to do that as simply as I can. I think those people are only focusing on one side of the labor market, the demand for labor. They're saying that if the cost of employing somebody goes up, I want to employ fewer people. But actually, you know, for somebody to be in a job in our economy, it's not just that somebody's got to want to employ them. I mean, they have, but they've also got to want the job. And so the supply of labor is important as well. And actually, when you raise the minimum wage, you make work more attractive to people. And so you tend to increase supply. And the actual outcome in terms of how many people are in work is a balance. It's a mix of those supply effects and those demand effects. And these people are just simply assuming that it's demand that determines everything. And that really isn't what economics says will happen in the labor market.
But now, in a situation in this country, we now have three job seekers for every job. I mean, is supply sensitive in that type of situation? In other words, why would one believe at a time where we have three people looking for every one job, why raising the wage would actually attract more workers?
Well, it's still the case. I mean, if you look at the evidence that when you pay higher wages, your workers are less likely to leave than before. You find it a bit easier to recruit workers. A lot of these low-wage sectors, even in labor markets like the ones that we have had in the last few years, which have been fairly extreme, I mean, they're not the normal situation, they find it hard to recruit and retain workers. And so higher wages actually help with that.
And is it possible that I've read in some instances where the raising the minimum wage could actually create more jobs? How does something like that happen?
Well, it can happen if the supply of people wanting to work goes up, and then as long as there's somebody who can an employer who can make a bit of money by employing them, they will do that. So if people don't want to work at the prevailing level of wages, then, you know, there isn't going to be any jobs. And, you know, that will happen whenever the supply effect, the effect of the minimum wage on increasing the supply of labor, dominates the is larger than the demand effect, that is the one that people normally often focus on to the exclusion of everything else.
Okay, well, Professor, I appreciate your time today walking us through this, and thanks very much.
You're welcome. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, folks. Sorry, we obviously had some problems with connecting with the professor, and the sound quality is not so great on that. But this is the issue here, of course, is going to be that President Obama is going to be raising the minimum wage by executive action on all workers who are federally contracted, or I should say under federal contractors, to at least $10.10 an hour. Like I said earlier, this is going to impact 560,000 workers. There's another 1.4 million low-wage workers whose jobs are supported indirectly by federal spending who won't be affected by this change. But ultimately, you know, this is part of the, at least is, you know, based upon the reporting that we've seen, the administration has determined at this point that their legacy in terms of their effectiveness is in danger right now, and that 2013 was a bit of a lost year for the Obama administration. I mean, I've read some stuff that I found quite shocking, frankly, that the administration is really just now learning about Republicans and their obstruction, which is, you know, sort of shocking. But be that as it may, and let's take that at face value for the time being. The idea here is to create some type of momentum and to drag the Republicans onto some very thin ice when they are arguing against the minimum wage. I mean, we have mentioned countless times on this program that study after study, which the professor referenced briefly anyways, that when you raise the minimum wage in a county of state A, let's say, that is contiguous to another county in state B, which has not raised their statewide minimum wage, you see no discernible impact on employment levels between those two counties, which suggests that there is very little cost in terms of jobs in raising the minimum wage. And in fact, Manapsoni argues that you would also see very little rise in prices in this instance, because of one, in terms of basically because you have the employer has this sort of monopoly on hiring, and because it continues to attract workers, you have less turnover, there's less of costs associated with that. But politically speaking, the on this U.S. contracts, understand that CEOs of these companies that get these U.S. contracts make $24 billion in taxpayer money each year. We have many of these companies who regularly violate U.S. labor laws. In 2012, companies doing business with the federal government had a combined 1,800 labor law violations. And again, of course, you know, the executive has the power to set specifics as to whom they will give federal contracts to. And so this is a rather uncontroversial move in some respects, at least in terms of the law. Many people are also asking at this point, however, if the president can and will mandate a minimum wage increase for government contracts, why not also do the same for a version of the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA, for federal contractors. ENDA, of course, says that you cannot discriminate against a potential worker for being gay. And I don't know why the president would think that's a bridge too far to go, but there's been no reporting that he's going to do the same for this. But the idea that the administration is now going to get involved in more executive action as a way of pushing through their agenda. We may see more happening on the immigration front. Some have suggested, I think David Dayen has a piece up now saying that the president can, in one fell swoop, help poor people and save the U.S. Postal Service. You know that the Postal Service has been running a deficit almost entirely as a function of a 2006 law that forces the post office to fully fund its pension benefits for 75 years out, a requirement that no other private company, government agency, anywhere in the country has. It was an attempt to put pressure on the postal services by Republicans who controlled Congress at the time as a way of essentially privatizing the U.S. Postal Service. As you know, the Postal Service takes no taxpayer money for its operations. It is fully funded, but for this deficit caused by a requirement that it fund this pension out on a 75-year horizon for workers who presumably will end up working for the post office who aren't even born yet. The post office is funded by stamps. David Dayen has suggested that there's no reason why the U.S. Postal Service cannot offer basic banking services, things like savings account, debit cards, perhaps even simple loans, check cashing. It's very problematic for people at the bottom end of the income spectrum, living in poverty, to maintain a bank account, to get a banking account, they pay exorbitant fees for check cashing services. It would both provide revenue for the post office, and provide services, banking services, at, according to the Postal Service Inspector General, conducting a study, shows that they could offer these banking services for about a 90% discount, saving the average underserved U.S. household over $2,000 a year, and providing the U.S. Postal Service with $8.9 billion in new annual profits, which would more than make up for its operating deficit. The report put out by the Inspector General calls simple financial services the single best new opportunity for the post office to earn additional revenue. It would also provide for a lot of Americans an opportunity to have a credit card, which, you know, or some type of debit card, which is, I would imagine, most people don't even realize just how crucial it is to their being able to basically function in today's society. We've also seen the large banks close branches in very low-income communities. There is a huge deficit of banking services for the poor in this country. So that's another thing that we could see the president do by executive action. We probably won't. Another low light of tonight's speech will be that the president apparently is jettisoning the phrase income inequality for a more plutocrat-friendly phrase. Let me see if I have this here. It is...
the phrase?
Yes,
it is.
He's
going to replace you, want me to tell you?
Ladders of opportunity.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Jesus. You'll recall back in December, he had a speech on income inequality. It was an okay speech, but really, in many respects, ignored the fact that income inequality did not just show up. It's not like the weather. It is a function of our government's failure on several fronts. The primary one, of course, being stagnant wages and a sort of an absence of a real desire to achieve full employment. The primary cause of stagnant wages in this country has been the weakening of private sector unions. I mean, we've also seen, you know, on a federal level, we haven't seen enough to promote more federal employment. We are down in a deficit of nearly 1.5 million federal jobs. But that's just since 2008. But it is the government that empowers corporations, and it is the government that empowers unions. And as corporations amass more power, more money, and the ability to unionize gets weaker and weaker, we begin to see things like income inequality, passing things like the TPP or its ancestors, NAFTA. And GATT also hurt American workers. I mean, so there's a lot of things that not necessarily can all be done by executive action, but they certainly aren't going to be done if we're afraid of addressing them in a speech. And we'll only talk about ladders of opportunity.
I think the other really important thing to bring up here, and there's no discussion about this in the United States, is the distinction between, of course, opportunity and meritocracy and giving people the opportunity to sort of move up the ladder are important. But then there's a whole other conversation about inequality, which is just raising the base, which we talk about a lot on this show, too, which is just raising, you know, the notion being that it shouldn't just be about somebody being able to leave a lower class and get to a higher class. It's about all classes having a higher standard of living and being paid more. So as soon as you have like a solely conversation that's just about ladders and opportunity, you're not necessarily addressing the kind of broader question of just raising everybody's standards.
Yeah. And just the turn of the phrase, I mean, ladders, I mean, you know, one person goes up at a time on a ladder. And I mean, that is what is problematic. You know, you're not talking about the issue isn't that we don't have ladders. The issue is that, in fact, there's just been bigger walls that are being built. And they are being built in the form of a federal and governmental bias against unions to the benefit of corporations. But the president is concerned that he will be seen as a class warrior if he talks about inequality, which is fairly stunning. I think I mentioned this.
I don't want to be a Nazi.
Yeah, exactly. We don't want Kristallnacht here. We will get to that.
Not just that. I mean, you hear any type of. I listened a few minutes to some NPR analyst, I think Mara Liasson, the other day, and it's amazing. Like the same talking points about how, well, the Democrats can't be this tax and spend party. That won't work. It's as if we're like in some type of fossilized time frame in the 1980s with these people.
And, you know, we still see, and of course, the biggest part of inequality, economic inequality, is that it breeds more economic inequality because it also breeds a tremendous amount of political inequality. And so once you get this ball rolling, you see that that income inequality lead to more corporate and uber wealthy friendly policies. Whether it's looking at capital gains tax, you know, the wealth is taxed less than labor is. Money is taxed less than labor is in this country. And we've seen the impact of income inequality just in terms of it forcing low and middle income people into more debt. As it also, we see it in terms of in this city in particular, as we see the cost of housing go further and further higher as it is driven by people who come in and will pay, you know, here's $8 million for an apartment, cash. Researchers at Harvard have found that women living in areas with large gaps between the haves and haves not are at greater risk of being depressed and are twice as likely to suffer from depression. Crime rates go up in areas where there is greater inequality. Obviously, we know the impact on our body politic. And it hurts long-term economic growth. So there's all sorts of reasons for this, for why we need ladders of opportunity. In this country, apparently. Apparently, in terms of long-term unemployment, the president is also expected to announce in the State of the Union that the White House has secured pledges from a number of U.S. major employers to adopt hiring policies that discourage discrimination against the long-term unemployed. I don't know what that's going to do. I mean, we promise not to have our human resources department take a jaundiced eye to people who have been unemployed for more than 12 months. Slightly a weak tea in my estimation, but that's what it is. Tomorrow we will have coverage of the State of the Union address. And also, are we going to have that, what's his first name?
Mr. Ruse.
Yeah, what's his first name? Austin Ruse?
Austin Ruse.
Okay, tomorrow, some time ago, I don't even know when we did this story. We did a story, I think, in the funner half about a guy, and I think I mentioned this last Wednesday when I got the tweets from this guy. Apparently, we did a story months and months ago, I think it was in 2013, about a guy who was watching his favorite Food Channel show with his 8-year-old. They DVR it, apparently. He runs some type of Families for American Freedom, or I don't know what it's called, with all due respect.
Save America USA.
Save
families.
America USA. Who knows what it is? And
it's called CFAM, Catholic Family and Human Rights Institute.
Okay, so the Catholic Families and Human Rights Institute. And he was watching this Food Network show, and I don't know if it was like one of those Iron Chef type of deals or what, but one of the contestants, I guess, was a woman married to another woman. She was obviously a lesbian, and he was on a radio show talking about how he had to shield his 8-year-old daughter when the daughter thought that she heard the woman say, "This is my wife." And he had to quickly say to his daughter, "No, no, she didn't say wife. She said life. This woman's my life." And he really took issue with the fact that he was being forced, this gay agenda was being forced upon him. And at the time, we mocked that video, as we are wont to do. I think we certainly mocked it. And apparently he was must have been Googling himself or just wading through our YouTube videos and started tweeting at me that he was, I don't know, that we didn't have enough Facebook followers or whatnot. And so I've invited him on the program to, if he wants to explain to us why gay people should not be on TV, I guess. I'm not sure what his position is exactly, but that could be interesting or fun. And we'll have him on maybe in the free show. Maybe, I don't know. We'll see what time he calls in. But that will be on the program tomorrow. And then I think Thursday, Janine Garofalo is going to be joining us. Mm-hmm.
As Janine Garofalo?
As Janine Garofalo, yeah.
Oh, nice.
So we haven't heard from Janine in 2014.
In studio?
I think we're going to try and do that.
Very fun.
So coming up in the funner half, we will play those clips from the Tom Perkins on Bloomberg, Bloomberg West, where Tom Perkins, of course, I guess explaining or defending his, what was it, a Wall Street Journal editorial?
It's a Wall Street Journal letter comparing, talking about inequality to Kristallnacht. And basically Gawker just put together the most cringe-inducing moments of this interview. And it's pretty amazing. You just got to listen to it.
Yes, we will. We will also give you an update on that story coming out of Texas. We will take your phone call, 646-257-3920. Folks, it is your support that makes this program possible. Become a member today at majority.fm. Don't forget, you can also support this program if you buy your crap through Amazon. You can make sure that we get a little piece of it without any difference to you. Go to majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the link, bookmark it, use that as your Amazon link. We get a piece of that. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate, 10% discount. Coupon code MAJORITY. It's a great company. Pick up our app at majorityapp.com. Give us a review on iTunes. Tell your friends. You can IM us or call us at 646-257-3920. Probably do a random rush. We'll be right back after this. Sitting up.